This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
So I want to tell you something that I haven't shared with anybody today.
Oh, good. I'm excited.
I got new printer ink, and there's just no feeling in the world like that.
Oh, can I say that I feel you from the bottom of my soul? I feel you. Getting new printer ink and installing it and watching it go through the drivers and actually happen, it's a beautiful thing.
It's kind of orgasmic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's forever. It's been your printer's low on ink. Okay. Your printer's low on ink. Okay. Your printer's low on ink. Then it was, we won't print unless you put more ink in. The ink came and I put that stuff in so fast in these mm-hmm. different slots that you put it in. And yeah. then it's just flowing. Like,
don't you love it when it like clicks and it goes click?
Oh,
and it goes,
my
it click.
God.
It all clicks into place. It just, you feel accomplished. You know what? For someone who's not a tech savvy person as well, it feels like you've just done something extremely technical.
Right. And all you did was slide it into a slot that is made for it. There was no heavy lifting involved. And then last week, you and I, we didn't have this type episode last week. I ordered staples from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And the shipment that came, I can honestly say, and it was a little unnerving. I'm 51 years old now. I mm-hmm. will not outlive my staple supply.
Oh, you have that many staples.
I have that many staples. Like,
why did you order so many?
I could
many?
Live to be 120 years old, and I will always have staples to put into the stapler that's sitting on right here, that's sitting on my desk. Which is a power-ass stapler. This thing, 25, wow. 30 pages, go right through it. But I'm telling you, many staples, I will die before they're finished.
I haven't stapled something in a long, long time. I believe you.
God, I believe you.
How do you staple so much? Like, what are you stapling all the time?
I'm stapling articles that I print for games that I do. Mm-hmm. I'm not green. I'll say it right now. I wish I were more green. I wish I was doing more to help the planet. But when I have to prepare for a game, I have to actually print articles out and highlight them.
Oh,
I need them. I need them in my hand. Like, I don't know how you are with a script. Like, I need to hold it and mark on it and think it through and go back over it. And yep. that I can't do it on a computer.
I was just about to say that. Like, when I have a script, I need to print it out to actually read the lines, learn the lines, write on it. I'm not good with digital printout, digital stuff. I like tangible. You know, even with books, I like to read a physical book, hold a book.
Absolutely. I will get a book, and if I'm into a book, and I just, Beneath a Scarlet Sky, I finished not long ago, mm-hmm. and I was going on a trip. The book weighs 1,000 pounds, and I didn't want to put it in my backpack, so I downloaded it onto my iPad, and it just, I don't get the same sense of satisfaction of actually turning the page.
I know.
I want to see progress. It's just not the same, and I feel so bad for my kids.
We're old school, though. We're so old school. Yeah, I love it.
But this rebel right here, I'll get people bitching and moaning at me for printing all this stuff out, but that's just my method. That's my madness and my method.
So you sent me a video, though, this morning of the back of your head. What the hell happened there? I didn't even know what it was because Michelle was filming it, and I didn't know whether you, honestly, not to bring this back up, got, you know, more hair plug surgery or if this was an accident. But what the fuck happened back there?
Well, here's the thing. I don't mind you ever bringing it up, obviously, but I feel like we've done enough podcasts now where we just keep going over the same shit. So my hair plug thing, you know, the Randy Moss thing, that's in this episode that we're leading into today.
What happened with the what happened with the Randy Moss thing?
What do you fuck off? And then you know, you and your dad walking out. I know.
Okay. So what happened with your hair?
So yesterday I'm playing in a golf match against a guy. Match play. I played borderline average, maybe worse. A guy that Tim Collins, shout out to Tim Collins in St. Louis. I thumped him last year. He'd be the first to tell you. I poured in 6 birdies on him. Yesterday was payback time. And he played okay. I played worse. And I just started drinking. And I was just depressed. And I kept drinking. And I kept drinking. Then I smoked a cigar because I thought, you know, I've had the cigar in my bag for over a year. The thing was like lighting up a piece of plastic. It had been in my bag for so long. It was like lighting a piece of wood.
It was so dry.
So dry. I thought the thing was going to like light my face on fire because it just was like.
No, it was a second and a half cigar. It just goes and gone.
So I smoked that. And then Michelle met me for dinner and we're drinking again. And I'm drunk by the time I get home. Michelle drove home. I was very proud of myself for not, you know, being stupid in that department. Get home. I'm looking in the mirror and I'm like, ugh, it's been so long since I've had a real haircut. And I looked at the back of my hair and it was white, gray, and it was stringy and long. And I had the shaver that they sent us from Manscaped. And I just like ripped up the back of my, and I felt so good. And then I was throwing the clumps of hair into Michelle's cleavage and she was getting, I mean, she was kind of mad, kind of not. And I just, this is how drunk I was. I did this with my hat still on. I went up the back of my head and I was like, man, that looks so much better. And it feels so much better because it's tight back there. But what I was too drunk or stupid to realize is that at a certain point, now it's still stringy and long and shitty and ugly right above that, which I can't see. And Michelle, this morning when we're getting the boys' breakfast ready, she's like, what did you do to the back of your hair? I was like, oh, shit, yeah, I did that.
Oh, and my God. It looks so bad. I love that you used the manscaper that we do ads for.
Right.
It's amazing.
It looks awful. It's embarrassing. I think I'll wear a hat until I can find it. Can you go get a haircut now? Is that legal?
Yeah,
is that?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it depends where you are, but I got my first haircut, but she came over here and cut my
all
whole family's
gloved
hair.
Up and masked
yeah, all
up
masked
and all
up and gloved up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I rented a 30-foot trailer, which I've never ever done before, and I'm hauling my family up north to go hang out in Oregon. And it sounds amazing, but it could be a total disaster. I've driven boats behind my car, you know, I've trailered boats, but nothing this huge. So I don't know what is going to happen.
So you're going to be in the car.
I'm in my truck and I'll be pulling the trailer. Okay. My brother and his wife are going, and then my mom and Kurt were like, hey, we're going too. So it's this family caravan, camping caravan, and we can't find a place to fit all three of us for the life of us. So we're just fucking winging it. It's going to be fun, but crazy. And I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be pure adventure, but I'm excited.
I'm just thinking of the person who's driving along the highway like Christy Brinkley in Vacation, who looks to the right and it's like, oh my God, there's Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. And then like 2 seconds later, is that Oliver? Is that Wyatt Russell and another? You just need Kate and you've got like the last 40 years of film covered on this caravan.
It's so funny you said that because I was, Aaron brought that exact same thing up because Kurt rented this big ass 35 foot RV, like a bus. So the front windshield is like flat and really open.
Who's going to drive that?
Kurt.
Him?
Not my mom.
No, I know, but I would think he'd get a driver. Is he capable of driving a big bus?
Yeah, Kurt's capable of pretty much doing anything. He'll figure everything.
In film.
He figures it out.
In film, he is.
No, I have a funny story, actually, about him just figuring it out. When I was about 12 years old, my brother Boston, you know, was, I don't know, 8, 9 years old. And we were in Colorado, springtime. The rivers were very high. It was, you know, obviously when you get that runoff, the rivers get really, really big. We went to go river rafting. We get to the spot. The guy says, you know, what do you want a guide? And Kurt says, nah, we're good. And the guy's like, well, Mr. Russell, like, I think you need a guide. It's really big out there right now. He goes, nah, I got it. And they're like, sir, you know, and by the way, this is mid-80s, so there was no real restrictions on anything, no rules. You could just go, you know what I mean? And he let us go. We get in this boat. There's a famous picture because we hit this rapid that was so gnarly. My brother flipped out of the back of the boat. I had to grab him, pull him back on. But there's a picture of Kurt with the paddle in one hand and he's screaming, hold on! And I am back in the back of the boat. You see my face. I'm bawling, crying. My face is contorted, crying. And we go through this insane rapid. Boston falls out of the boat. I have to reach back and pull him back in. We made it. The point of the story is Kurt didn't really know. He didn't really know what he was doing, but he figured that shit out. And we got out alive.
God, that is, I got to see this picture. First
oh,
of
it's
all.
It's an amazing.
Where
picture.
Is it?
It's
Where's
classic.
The picture?
I have it here.
I have, it?
In my garage. Yeah.
Does Kurt have it up on the wall?
No, no.
Why? I would, if that were me and the boys are behind me and I'm got an oar in one hand and like a Bud Light in the other, yelling, "Come on, hold on!"
Oh,
that'd
I know.
Be up
it
on
was,
every wall in my I, in every room of my house.
That yelp, that scream of his in that moment is seared into my memory. Hold on! And the picture was taken right at on.
Who took the picture?
There was a guy.
Picture?
There was a guy doing photographs up there for the outfit. You know, for the river rafting outfit. And it was a rapid called Steel Bridge Rapids. And right as he was doing the on, they took the picture. So Kurt's mouth is wide open. I'm crying.
Oh my God.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is like Overboard 2, or what was the other the seafaring movie that Kurt and your mom did?
That was Overboard.
Jack,
oh,
was
Captain
Overboard?
Ron?
Captain, it's Captain Ron.
It was
Captain
very Captain Ron.
Ron.
Yeah, he channeled that experience for Captain Ron. You know, well that's part
God.
Of the reason I'm in therapy. You know. And speaking
of
therapy,
that one scream, because of that one primal scream,
it was.
Hold on,
yeah. If only
Maybe he's just cheap. Is he cheap? He didn't want to pay for a guy.
No. He just likes to do things himself. You know, which I can totally appreciate. You know, I get that. It's like, nah, let's do. We got it. Let's do it. You know, that's
okay.
That's his deal.
Doesn't he fly planes too, or helicopters, or does
planes,
he do any
yeah,
of that?
He's a pilot. He's a badass man.
Is it, yeah, no, he's a stud.
He's a badass
he's
man.
Better, or worse pilot than Harrison Ford, if you had to guess.
Oh God, way better. Come on.
Right.
Harrison crashed his plane at Penmar Golf Course.
like in hey, Venice. It's Han Solo.
Totally. Hey, Han. Imagine like, babe, hand me my 8-iron. Holy shit. It's Harrison Ford.
I think this breaks right to left. My God, it's Han Solo.
Totally.
All right. After all that time that you've wasted listening on your headset, wherever you may be in this great country, on to our guest, one of the hottest comics in the world, not just the country, and somebody that if my daughters and I share one comedian's work via text and copying and pasting and links to different shows, it's Sebastian Maniscalco. In fact, I have a sweatshirt purchased by my youngest daughter, Trudy, after going to one of his shows. He is brilliant. He is Sebastian, and he is here. Well, we have this podcast that we call Daddy Issues, and I have my own. I live in my dad's shadow. Oliver lives in every member of his family's shadow, at least in his own mind. And it's interesting, Sebastian, to go back through your history and your family's history and see the relationship you have with your mom and dad and how that's been passed down now to your young kids. And it seems like your dad has been a pretty constant presence from the beginning for you, Sebastian.
Yeah, well, my dad is mainly the focal point of my entire act. Although when I was young, my dad worked like a bull, still is, 74 years old. He's a hairdresser. He's still doing dye jobs. So he and I really connected over, and it's funny, the Bulls championships during the 90s, we connected over me playing soccer and us watching the Bulls games. And he's always been my biggest fan and my biggest critic. And he comes to shows, and he's very passionate about what I do. It caused some tension early on because he would give me a lot of critiques about what I was doing and how I was doing it. And we kind of finally reached a point where he could just come and enjoy the show as a fan, not as a parent.
Does he have the credentials? You know what I mean? Like, you're the comic. Like, how is he saying, hey, listen, what are you saying here? I mean,
if you ever talk to my dad, he would say, I know funny, okay? And that's not funny.
Does he know funny, though? I mean, is he a funny man, you know?
Yeah, he is, he's a character.
Yeah.
We've always laughed with one another. We crack each other up. And he's like one of my best friends now. But in the early goings of it, he was just, you know, he was working. My mom was raising the family. He was working. And now that I'm a father of two small kids, 3 and 1 years old, I always wrestle now with, like, how much time do I allocate towards being a dad and being with my kids? I allocate towards, especially now, being 71 days in the house. It's very difficult to not, like, feel guilty because you're not playing with your daughter or your son. And you start to feel like, what's the proper balance? I haven't figured that out yet.
No, I know, dude. I wrestle with that, you know, myself. I've got 3 kids, 12, 10, and 6. You know, my dad left when I was young. And then Kurt, my stepdad, came into my life. And was there, obviously, he was present, but they're making movies. My mom was making movies. I was always sort of skipping around and, you know, it's business. They have to go do their job. But I think something happened to me where I just went hyper dad, you know, because I didn't have the attention that I probably needed. My kids are my top priority, you know, over my career, over everything. You know, I've had moments with my agents where they're like, you got to get your shit together. I'm like, you guys, sorry, this is what's important to me. You know what I mean? I don't want to go to Bulgaria for 4 months. I need to be with my children, you know?
What the hell are you shooting in Bulgaria?
Lots of shit shoots in Bulgaria.
Really?
Yeah.
Shut up. Like what?
I didn't do the job, so I don't know. But a lot of things shoot in Bulgaria. Trust me,
I feel the same as you, Sebastian. Like I've got daughters that are 23 and 20, and now I've done it all over again with 2-year-old twin boys. And now that we're all kind of in this confined area, it's hard to be in the other room and not feel that guilty pull into their room, even though they're taken care of or being watched or somebody's there to help. And that's the constant struggle I have all day. So therefore, I feel like at the end of the day, I'm ready for bed about 6 minutes after they are at 7:30. And it's been a constant push and pull with my guilt factor of trying to, you know, have my own time, but yet be involved as the super dad. It's a lot. And I think this has made us all kind of reevaluate what we've done with our time. You know, you've been in the game now for 3 years and I've been in it twice over for 20 plus. It's made me reevaluate all the time that I have spent away and what I do with my time when I'm in my house and they're two rooms away.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you add that travel component in, whether it be shooting a movie or broadcasting or doing stand-up, you know, when you're not in the home, you don't necessarily, it's like out of sight, out of mind. It's like you're away doing your thing. And then when you reinsert yourself back into home life, you know, you feel a little bit, I don't know, for me at least, when I would go on the road and come back, I would feel like reinvigorated with, you know, getting involved. And I couldn't, I am built to work. That's just how I'm programmed. I feel whole when I am out earning and providing. And that's just how I'm wired. Not that I'm not wired to be a family man, I am, but I cannot, you know, to play with a 3 and a 1 year old for 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And completely honest, maybe some people wouldn't admit that, but you know, in like, if you carve out some really quality time, the problem I'm having is quality versus quantity. If it's an hour and a half where I go and me and my daughter go in the pool, we go swimming or we take a ride or whatever, I have to within myself say, you know what, that was our time together. Now it's time for daddy to go and work or do what he needs to do. So I could give what I need to give in those moments because, you know, like you're saying, you know, you're in your office and two rooms away, you hear, you know, fun or, and, or they're having with mommy or a nanny. Then when you had a nanny on the whole thing, I didn't grow up with a nanny. So it was my parents, my grandparents, aunts and uncles. It was more like the family kind of pitched in. But when you move away from your family and you really don't have that like support system, you have to hire the support system. And then you feel almost a little bit guilty of like the nanny's doing such a great job. And then you're like, man, is the kids having more fun with the nanny than she's having more with me? It's just, it's a
kind of. Now you're competitive. She's not that great, kids. I'm telling you right now, your dad, I got it. Okay. She's fun, but I got it. No, I know. I'm the same way. Our nanny is like on, I don't even know what, is like, tomorrow we're going to go to a strawberry farm. Like, that sounds so horrible to me.
Oh,
I can't
God,
even
I know.
Tell you. And she's like, oh my God, we had the best time. Blake and Wyatt loved every second at the strawberry farm. I'm like, God bless you. I can't do it. I'm 51 years old. I don't want to go to the strawberry farm.
No, I'm telling you, like some of the worst times with the kids are holidays. Like, oh fuck, we got to go to the pumpkin patch. Like, I don't really want to go to the pumpkin patch at all. It's just hell. Or you got to go get a Christmas tree. Everything is sort of a planned outing. But I will say, dude, what you said is true. I believe that it's quality over quantity. There are plenty of parents who are there all the time who don't play with their kids, you know, who don't, you know, engage with their kids. They'll ignore them. If you get 2 or 3 solid hours, memorable hours with your kids, you know, that's what counts. You know, and I think morning and bedtime, those are the two big ones, I think. Like waking up with them, being present for that morning, and then getting them in bed and having that nighttime ritual. You know, I mean, you're good on the front end, the back end. The middle of the day is kind of a wash, you know?
Yeah, and you guys could probably speak to this more because you have older kids. I'm hearing once they, you know, begin to grow, yeah, and
it gets fun,
it gets, yeah, a little bit more, you know, interactive. You know, my daughter now is, you know, talking and she's 3 years old, and now I'm starting to see like, oh my God, yeah, this is. But you know, when they're infant and breastfeeding and sleeping, and it's just like, for a while I was just trying to figure out where do I insert myself into this equation.
Yeah.
Breastfeeding. I would start with breastfeeding. I don't think that's wrong. You got to still date your wife. Has your wife say that all the time? My wife, we still have to date. We still have to date. I'm like, this is the energy I have. We're within this framework. We can date or we can raise 2-year-old twin boys. You pick. But when they're down, the dating is that shot. Unless we have a lot of help.
Yeah, you can't even go out anyway now with what's going on. We, for the last 73 days, I've literally cooked every meal in the house. My wife doesn't do any of the cooking. So I feel like I'm running a hotel over here. I get up at 5 every morning waiting for my guests to come down for brunch. It's like they kept us inside with the pandemic. And now I live in Los Angeles. I feel like I'm a teenager again asking what the curfew is.
I know, it's crazy. I'm here too. I'm in LA as well. You know, it's true. But I think, you know, I've said this before, it's not about if you fuck up your kids. It's sort of just to what degree you fuck up your kids. We're screwing them up one way or the other. We're just trying our best. And you know, it's just about the degree. We're all fucked up in some kind of a way. And the other thing too is there's this idea that you have to sort of have love at first sight. You know, when you have a kid, everyone says, oh, it was love at first sight. Don't fall into that trap. Maybe it will happen. But most of the time, it's like, holy shit, what is going on right now? This alien being has just emerged from my wife. And now it's all this shit all over it. And it's going into this thing. You know, for me, it wasn't love at first sight. I mean, I had to grow into the love for my children because it was just a shock to the system for me, you know. Oh, and I had no guilt about that, though. You know what I mean?
Well, I had to take a couple walks around the block because for the first couple of years, my daughter really was solely into mommy. And I was like, wow, this, you know, I mean, I thought, what happened to daddy's little girl?
Oh, that's coming. Don't worry.
That's coming.
They run to daddy when stuff is sideways, with mommy especially. It's coming. You got it. Don't worry about it.
Hey, were you born in Italy and then you came over with your fam?
No, my father was born there when he was 15.
In Sicily, right?
Yeah, he's from Sicily. We went back about, I'd say, 10 years ago for a father and son trip. He hadn't been back since he left 50 years, and I've never been. Wow. Because he went down with quadruple bypass surgery, and I said, listen, let's plan a trip before you pass away. Uh-huh. And shortly after he got out of the hospital, we arranged a trip. And I'm so glad we did it because now he goes back every year, and he's reconnected with friends and family that, you know, he lost touch with over the last 50 years. And he goes back to his small town in Cefalù, Sicily. And, you know, he's like the mayor now. So, yeah, it was a nice trip. I'm really glad we took the time to do it, because if we hadn't, I think that would have been a huge missing on both of our parts. So
my whole side of the family, my dad's side of the family, is Sicilian as well. So I'm sure our families have crossed paths. We're the Salernos. That's like our family are the Salernos. And my great grandfather lived in Naples, and he met my grandmother Tessie in New York. He was he came through Ellis, but he was his brother. My great grandfather's brother is Big Fat Salerno, who was the head of the Genovese.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Which is crazy. I found this out like, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago when my sister and I sort of got into the whole ancestry thing. And then we started calling our side of the family, my dad's side of the family, who we don't have a lot of contact with, but we were just curious, you know. So it turns out that was the whole history of, you know, the Salernos. And then they went to Portland, you know, and my grandmother was my my great grandmother was just badass too when it came to all that stuff. She was like running numbers. I mean, it's this whole world that was exposed to us about 6 years ago.
But what if they got all this from your spit? What if they sent this same story to like 100 people?
No.
Just because you sent your spit in a vial into some website. Now you know that your grandmother was running numbers.
What do you mean? You're saying that everyone is getting the same story? What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm talking about. And so I think Sebastian's with me on this.
Well, you know, it's that, like it must be crazy to like join like ancestry.com and the tree tells you you're connected to the mob.
I know, it's crazy.
God, I'm learning more about you, Oliver, than any of our guests. Every time you got more shit that you come up with. I don't. What are you sitting on this stuff? You're like, okay, I'm going to release this one this week. How do you keep coming up with
just,
this stuff?
It's an organic conversation. You know, we're both from sort of the same parts of the world, I guess. You know,
yeah,
that's all.
So your dad continues to work to this day, which, I mean, says all you need to really know about your dad in his mid-70s, still cutting hair and dyeing hair and whatever the hell he does.
He's, it took, I mean, when he took the 2 months off for COVID, the quarantine, he was going nuts. I mean, this is a guy who doesn't golf, doesn't have hobbies, doesn't do any of that stuff. Work is his life. And he was climbing up a wall, and now he went back, and I go, aren't you worried about maybe the virus? You're, you know, 74 years old. You're kind of in that age group. You got hypertension. And he's like, hey, if I die behind the chair, I die behind the chairs.
Some die in a chair. Some die behind the chair.
So
it's all your perspective.
So let's go back to your childhood for just a second. So brothers and sisters, what do you got there?
I got a sister who's younger. She's 5 years younger. She's out here in Los Angeles editing. And my mother is out here in L.A.
You're the oldest.
Yeah, I'm the oldest. So when they divorced, it threw me a curveball because I just didn't see it coming. And, you know, you always kind of hear about people or kids who deal with a divorce at a young age, but you never really hear, you know, how someone deals with a divorce in their late 30s.
Oh my God. And how did that hit you? I mean, that's crazy shit.
Yeah, it took a while. You know, like, I never thought I'd see my mother at 74 years old on eHarmony. You know, I always thought I was going to call back to my house and my mother was going to hand my dad the phone. I wasn't going to have to do two separate Christmases or two separate Thanksgivings or what have you. So, it's been an adjustment over the years. I could kind of laugh about it now, but when it happened, it was something that I couldn't really pull humor from because I needed some time to kind of like let it sink in. And then that's with a lot of humor. It doesn't sometimes happen right in the beginning. You just have to let it marinate a little bit.
How long were they married?
They were probably married 35 years, 34 years.
But I would imagine, Sebastian, that makes you go back and reevaluate things that you thought as a kid. I mean, I even do that in therapy myself with how I perceived my mom and dad's marriage and how now being on the other side of it, looking back and going, you start to connect dots. Have you done any of that? Did you go, okay, you know, this was just how all you knew, but does it make you think of your childhood any differently or think of, you know, their relationship that at one point was one thing to you and now in your late 30s was another?
Yeah, well, they didn't really show us the problems in the marriage. Plus, then I moved out to Los Angeles when I was 24 years old, so I probably didn't see a lot of that kind of escalating back in Chicago. So, it's kind of, you know, I haven't done any therapy or anything close to like talking that out. Although I always tell my wife that I would like to someday kind of just, you know, like I actually interviewed like a therapist over the phone and we had a conversation. And right away, I'm like, I know this guy. I mean, like, how do you find a good therapist? What, you got to go through a few?
The worst thing is every time you go to a new one, or if you were to interview, you got to start back. Well, I was born in Chicago. And then it's like you got to go through 40 years of your life. And then by that point, you're either in or you're out. I don't want to keep telling the same story. That's the hard thing, I think. I mean, Oliver, you and Kate have had this guru you guys talk to that seems to be good for you.
I like him. I was in therapy for 15, 16 years with the same guy. But it got to the point where I would go into the session and sit down in the chair and it would just be silent. And he's a great man. He was a really great man, but he had this like little mustache. He looked like Jim Croce. He looks exactly like Jim Croce. And he would just sit there and look at me. And no words were said. And finally, his name was Jan. I'm like, Jan, like, what are you thinking, man? Like, what are we doing right now? He goes, I'm just holding you in the space. And I'm like, but this is, nothing's happening right now, you know? So I had to get out of that because I needed a different kind of therapy. And then I found this guy that I really like. But
the other hard thing is going through a divorce, which I did, and then sending your kids to a therapist and you're not even in there. So they're in there talking to some therapist who, because they have their name on a diploma from somewhere and they have an office, that tells you that they're obviously the greatest therapist ever. I don't know what's going on in there. And then eventually both my daughters like, we don't say anything. She doesn't say anything. And I'm like, well, okay, let's try another one. And then
did you just do this because your wife, was she like, she's like, honey, you need to at least like try. And you're like, okay.
You know what? I came to it on my own. Like, you know, I'm 46 years old and I tried it when I was 6 years ago. I went to a couple of sessions, but yeah, just to go and talk to somebody other than the people that are in my life. You know, I mean, I don't know what that, you know, again, you guys could speak to it more than I can, but like what that does.
And the irony of it is, isn't your dad kind of a de facto therapist? Isn't that why sometimes, you know, that's what the hairdresser becomes almost, because you're a captive audience in a chair and they're hearing everybody's life. So, I mean, is that part of kind of his, I'm sure the people get enjoyment out of sitting in that chair, just talking to your dad.
You know, he's kind of been, you know, in my ear, giving me advice, or kind of a quasi therapist, I guess, if you like to call him that. Just, he's been kind of the guy I go to for guidance. But yeah, just to try somebody outside the circle of my family, I don't know, I'd give it a shot.
You were in a really weird position, though. You know, like you said, you were 30 something years old when your parents split up. That's crazy in a way, what that does. You know, do you take sides? Like, kids take sides with mom or dad? Like, what's the point? What the fuck are you doing? You're 70 some years old. Why not just live it out?
Yeah, that's what my dad didn't want to do. I you know, I just think he wanted, he wasn't happy. He didn't want to live the rest of his life. I mean, I make a joke. I mean, Italians just normally die unhappy. They don't, you know, they get divorced, but they got divorced and I didn't take sides. I love them equally. It's not, I didn't come from that type of family. Our family is not really dysfunctional in the sense where there was not a, you know, I didn't come home and a lot of yelling. I mean, we had disagreements and what have you, but I didn't grow up in a family which is really dysfunctional. There was no abuse or alcoholism or drugs or anything like that. So for me, I had a pretty normal childhood in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. We just sit around the kitchen table, had dinner as a family, and had a ball, really laughed. I was the type of guy that everybody came over to my house to hang out with my parents because they were the cool parents, and they talked to, you know, but before we went out to a dance club, we would come and get a little liquored up at my house and then go out to a dance club. But my parents were like, you know, almost wishing they could come with us.
But I feel like that's your, to me, as a fan of yours, that's such an appealing aspect to you as a comedian, to you, I would assume, as a person, because I feel like all other comics are also, not all, but most, seem to come from this dark place where, you know, it all kind of funnels back to, you know, if you really boil it down, it's really dark. And when I watch you and you're talking about, you know, we've got company and, you know, that's how it was in my house. And it's like, hey, don't touch the, I could listen to you say Entenmann's cake, you know, but now it's like there's a samurai sword taped under the couch. Yeah. That's how life has changed. But I grew up, you know, I'm a handful of years older than you, but that's the relatable part, that it's like, oh my God. Yeah. So I guess I was thinking today, you have to test that stuff out to think, you know, that what you experienced as a kid with quote unquote company, is relatable for other people, because that's, it was so much so in my life. But, you know, I don't know. I would imagine that gets a little treacherous or scary trying that kind of stuff out, because it's just observational. Here's how I grew up. Is it funny to you? And the answer is obviously yes.
Yeah, I think you're right, though, with a lot of these comedians, and even for myself, I love to laugh myself. But sometimes I tune into comedians and I'm like, I can't even relate to, I can't even relate to what they're talking about. Or, you know, for me as a comedian, I'm like, listen, everybody grew up, they had probably similar upbringings. And let me just talk about kind of my experience, my observations growing up.
Your road for somebody as successful as you, to the outsider, I look at you and I go, oh my God, this has been a quick burst. But for you, I'm sure you're thinking, man, I've been slugging it out here, you know, whether it was working at the Four Seasons or whatever was going on in your life, trying to do what we've seen over the last, I don't know, 5-6 years, whatever it's been for you with this kind of explosion. But really the overall time that you've been a quote unquote stand-up comedian is not that long. Am I right on that? Am I off on that?
Well, it depends what you think long is. I mean, I started in 1998 doing this, so it's been over the course of 20 years. So it does take a while for a comedian to kind of, or at least for me, I didn't have any TV show or movie that kind of catapulted me into arenas or whatnot. This was basically going to comedy clubs year in, year out, shaking people's hands after shows, taking pictures with them, selling my DVDs, and then subsequently them coming back with their neighbor or a friend of theirs or their family. And it just kind of snowballed. I mean, I would start seeing groups of 14, 16 people showing up at comedy clubs because they're like, man, this guy, feel like this guy grew up with us. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, 22 years, it's been in the world of stand-up comedy, it's, you know, I would consider myself becoming a seasoned veteran, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Did you evolve? Did your comedy evolve? I mean, from day one till now? I mean, were you a different comic back then?
Oh, yeah. I look at the comedy I was doing when I first arrived. Very angry, very unlikable. No real, like, letting the audience in. No real personal stuff. I did a lot of kind of broad-based humor. I didn't ever really got into my family and my upbringing. And that's when it really kind of turned for me, when I started talking about those little morsels of personal anecdotes that people started really kind of gravitating towards the humor.
How did that happen, though? Like, was there a moment of that? I know evolution is over time, but was there a flashbulb moment where it was like, oh, you know what? This is the path that I need to go on now. Like, how did that change for you?
Well, I remember when I did one of my specials called What's Wrong With People, I did a joke about how Italians don't bring a gift. They bring an envelope of cash. And it was this whole thing centered around the cash that you get at an Italian wedding. And I thought to myself, should I leave that in there during the editing process? I mean, should I leave that in there, or is it too specific where people are going to go, wow, dang, what? But I left it in there, and I'm so glad I did, because that's a joke that a lot of people kind of resonated with, particularly the Italian Americans and immigrant type families. You don't have to be Italian to get the humor. You could be Greek or Spanish, or really resonated with that group of people. And I kind of took the ball and ran with it from there and started talking about my father and his way of thinking and, you know, whatever, just growing up in the garden and killing, raccoons with bologna, which he never did. You get people complaining, oh, hey, your dad killed, you know, animals with antifreeze. It's just like, no, I heard that story from a friend of mine's father, and I just gave that whole story to my dad.
Yeah, there's creative license when you know in your bits, for sure. I mean, that's just the way it is. That's the way it has to be, honestly, you know.
Yeah.
people wonder when I am watching a sporting event, if, and I'm on my couch, if I'm doing the play-by-play in my head, if as you go through life and you're an observational type comedian, I mean, do you, is that inner voice ever shut up? Like, are you constantly like kind of grinding on what you see around you and how you can turn it into something funny?
Well, first of all, do you, when you watch a game?
I do. Yeah, I do. I can't not, I can't not think in my head, especially hockey, which I don't do, and it's quicker, and I'm trying to think, man, could I do this? Am I smart enough to say Ovechkin to Svetnikov over to, you know, that kind of stuff, and do that type of play-by-play? So hockey is the one that's always in my head. But, yeah, if I'm watching a big game, I'm critiquing the person I'm watching, and I'm trying to do it myself all at the same time. And I would imagine for you, you have a notebook, or you're using voice notes, or do you just remember it, or do you hope you remember it when you're going through the daily life?
Well, in a normal setting, if the Comedy Store was open here in Los Angeles, I would go there every night. And then if something happened during the day that I thought was funny, I would make a mental note to go, I want to talk about this tonight on the stage. I really haven't had that outlet in the last 75 days, obviously, because you just can't do stand-up comedy right now in Los Angeles. So my thoughts have been very internalized, and I did a couple of corporate Zoom events. The offer came in and like, can you do 40 minutes? And I'm like, listen, comedy doesn't work standing in front of a laptop. the way I structured it was more of a sit down, almost like if I were to go on Jimmy Fallon or Jimmy Kimmel, where the setups are given in this situation by the moderator. And then I would just tell a funny story sitting down and then pick on people on Zoom. You know, would scroll through the page and like pick on people. And it actually worked out really well. I was really reluctant to do it because I'm like, this ain't gonna work. But it kind of did. So I've been getting some of the internal thoughts about pandemic, family life, and what have you out in that manner. Plus, I have a podcast myself once a week with Pete Coriolli, which we exchange stories about our personal and professional lives. But when I do record, when I do stand up, I always record it and then I play it back to find out kind of where the beats are and then work on it the next night.
Right. But do you do a lot of riffing? You know, I mean, you know, it's not a lot of memorization. It's a lot of just sort of, here's my story and here's how I'm going to tell it.
Yeah, it would be like, you know, you telling the story about you finding out about Ancestry.com. You're just recanting that happened in your, and then you're playing it back in your head and regurgitating the information. So as far as riffing is concerned, it's not like I do a lot of crowd work, but if I do have an idea on stage that I didn't plan on doing, those to me are kind of like almost the best ones because they were in your brain somewhere. Mm-hmm. And if it's unplanned, those could be like gems.
Yeah. Well, you also tell a story so many times that it's just a part of you. You know, like I love storytelling in general. You know, I think it's the best way to communicate. Even learning, like my kids, you know, telling a story is one of the great ways to learn and to laugh and to communicate. And I've told stories so many times that, you know, boom, they're right in my head and I can tell them and I know the beats of the story because I have just told it so many times, even though it's not verbatim, you know?
Yeah.
I wonder though, and sorry to geek out on the whole stand-up world, but I've been on national TV and I've asked, let's say, Troy Aikman the first question in our little stand-up. He does his answer and then I'm just stuck. I'm like, wait, what the hell am I supposed to lead him into now about the Eagles defense or whatever it is? Because you get, I don't know, your mind jumps the track or something. And I, that's what I'm always fascinated with, the transitions that the great ones do where you're not making it feel like a routine as much as you're just thinking out loud. And have you ever been stuck? Like, where am I? And I just got a laugh that I didn't expect, or I didn't get a laugh when I did expect it. And now where do I go from here? Do you get that ever?
Got that on national TV on Jimmy Fallon's show. Oh. I was a minute into my act and I completely went blank. I couldn't remember anything, and they had cue cards, and I remember I couldn't even see the cue cards. It was like almost blurry, and I'm sitting there in the microphone, and I'm like, I kept saying, I'm Italian. It was almost like coming down with some type of Alzheimer's in the moment. And then I turned to the band, and they looked at me and they're like, bro, we don't know your act. So it felt like it lasted for 28 minutes, but it was only 10 seconds. And then I snapped back out of it and I picked it up. And I was so embarrassed when I came back to the couch and I told Jimmy, I said, I'm so sorry, bro. I don't know what happened to me out there. He said, no, don't worry about that. It happens all the time. We'll just cut it out and piece it together and post. And I could not stop thinking about it until I saw it. And once I saw it, I'm like, oh, that was really clean. But if you go back and watch it, you could see me come out of a coma. But yeah, that's the only time it really happened like that. And I don't know why it happened. But yeah, sometimes you're surprised when you're doing stand-up, whether it be a joke comes out that you didn't expect, a laugh that you expect that you don't get as big a laugh on. You know, there's a lot going on in my head.
Isn't it that internal voice, though? You know, that's, you're waiting for that beat, as you guys call it, and then you don't get the laugh, and then the internal voice goes, oh, why didn't I get a laugh right there? And then it's like, wait, whoa, okay, I got to stay in this. You know, that internal voice, that's what I try to shut off when I'm on doing a Super Bowl to 100 million people, and you're like, man, I just want to get through this clean and not embarrass myself. And if I can go to bed tonight not in a cold sweat because I just screwed this up, I'll be happy.
Like,
and
when Randy Moss peed on the goal, on the, like that.
Exactly. Yeah. That. Right. Exactly.
What happened?
He's giving me shit for the 9,000th time.
It's one of Joe's worst moments in broadcasting.
To you. To you, it's one of
my worst
moments.
To a lot of people. To a lot of people.
In Green Bay, he scores a touchdown. He's a Viking at the time. Scores a touchdown, and he goes to the end zone, and he pantomimes, like, pulling his pants down and mooning the crowd, and then goes over to the goalpost and kind of rubs his ass on it. And I said, that's disgusting, and we shouldn't show that in replay. And it just came out, and I had to pay for that for the next 2 weeks in the sports talk shows. All of a sudden, I was the bad guy, and you know, he got fined, and that was when that, I don't know if you remember, but they caught him in the parking lot. They're like, Randy, how are you going to pay for this $10,000 fine? He's like, straight cash, homie.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what that was from.
Yeah.
So that was all from that whole thing. And the spotlight kind of swung around on me.
Yeah, that was a good one. The other good one was U.S. Open, Brooks Koepka's girlfriend that was not the right girl.
Are we just doing my shittiest hits?
It's just fun, you know what I mean? That was
it's fun for you.
That was a great
it's
one.
It's fun for you.
Wait, did he, wait, with that one,
don't you have to go clean Kate's pool or something?
Just wait a minute. Was it the wrong girlfriend? It was his ex-girlfriend's name that you used? Is that what it was?
Yeah, so some guy hands me a card who I've never said his name out loud or publicly. He's never been heard from since. He handed me a card, you know, that's his girlfriend, whatever, Karen. And Sandra, and I read it, and then Brad Faxon, I'm working with, is like, no, actually, Brooks and Sandra broke up. That's his new girlfriend. That's Jenna Sims. I'm like, that was the last thing we did after four straight days of like 9 hours of live TV. It's like, okay, well, just fuck that up. Good night, everybody. And then that, I got to chew on that for the rest of the year.
Were you a big Chicago sports fan, Sebastian?
Yeah, I still am. All of them.
Blackhawks, Bears.
I've been in LA for 22 years, and I used to love the Showtime Lakers in the 80s, but haven't adopted any of the teams here as my own. I always you know, Blackhawks, Bulls, Bears, White Sox more than Cubs, but I don't hate the Cubs. But yeah, I just grew up watching those guys. And
was your dad a sports fan?
Yeah, like I said earlier, him and I really bonded over the Bulls, but he's a diehard Bears fan. He loves the Bears, but I don't know if he loves the Bears, but there's really nothing to cheer about every year. So we get our kicks and calling each other during the game and go, did you see that? What the hell is he?
So I want them to be good. Life is good when the Chicago Bears are good. And it's come in little spurts over the 20 years I've been doing it. But man, when that city's lit up for the Bears, it is just, there's nothing better. The dead of winter, Soldier Field freezing. And I mean, that's just what football's all about. So every year I'm like, God, please have a good draft. God, figure it out. I just want to see that team, you know, relevant and rise. You referenced Alzheimer's earlier with the Fallon thing. I know that's where some of your foundation money goes to, because your grandfather had it. My grandfather had it, which I witnessed as a kid. And I mean, there are a few things as horrible to watch as watching somebody not know who they are, where they are, who's around them, you know, just be as unnerved as somebody in the throes of Alzheimer's really is. Is that something you think about a lot? Like, am I genetically programmed for this, or you? Because I do. I'm the worst hypochondriac of all time.
No, I don't think about that. I am a hypochondriac in other ways. I don't necessarily think, oh, my father has hypertension. Although my father will tell me that you better be worried about having a heart attack. I don't know if that's something every dad tells son, but I remember him FaceTime 5 weeks ago, mid pandemic, and he's like, "You're having too much meat." I go, "What? Stop it with the meat." So, even at four, he's trying to tell
you what to do. It doesn't end. I'm 51, and my mom is like, and there's nothing you can say, nothing I can say. So I was like, "I think I did okay with you." You know, like she's trying to insert herself into me raising my 48 kids that I now have. And
you're pretty healthy though, right? I mean, you eat well and you work out, right? Is that part of your life?
I have pre-pandemic. I was on a good roll.
Yeah.
It's when I go on the road, I really eat clean. I don't drink at all. When I come home, then my wife and I, we kind of really bond over food and wine and dinner.
I love that. I love that.
It's really great. And so needless to say, I think between my wife and I have had 75 bottles.
Oh, I know, man. I know. God, I know.
Well, you need a counter on the wall.
Is she Italian as well?
She's Jewish. She's a Spanish Jew from Memphis, Tennessee. And she likes food as much as I do. And it's really kind of like, we got married in Napa. We love going to Italy. We love entertaining people at the house and seeing people enjoy our cooking or what have you. So, yeah, I've gained some weight over this pandemic.
Oh, yeah, but you're a cook. You love to cook.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm making Michael Villaggio's type of plates over here. But, you know, I love meat. I love making eggplant. I love fish. I do a nice little ass with some mixed vegetables, you know, simple stuff, nothing with heavy ingredients.
No, I know, but I've always loved to cook, you know, but in this pandemic, I'm like borderline obsessed with it now. Like, I want to continue on. I love it so much. It's so fun. I mean, it's so gratifying. You know,
it's rewarding in that sense. And that's kind of where I've gotten. I love making breakfast for my daughter and my son and watching them eat. It's, I don't know, it's part of the Italian culture, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's nice. It is good, man.
As we wind down, we like to ask a question that Oliver thought of. And I think it's worthwhile, especially for you, with regard to you as a dad of young kids. As you look back, what is an attribute your dad showed as a father that you've carried forward and you're glad that you did? And is there anything, be it hypertension or anything else, that he did or exemplified as when you were younger that you wish you hadn't picked up from him?
Well, in regards to parenting, I want to instill in my kids the same thing he instilled in me, which was like work ethic. You got to work to get to where you need to be. No one's going to give you anything. I like that mentality. And I want to like definitely give that to my kids. However, it's funny navigating these waters. I grew up in a working middle-class family and, you know, like I said, one vacation a year, my dad brought a lot of cash with him on the vacation. When that ran out, we got back in the car and we drove back home. There was no credit cards, nothing like that. And we went to a Bulls game, but all he could afford was, you know, upper deck, third balcony, obstructed view, you know. And then as I became more successful and be able to afford a better seat and what have you, I always run in my back of my head, I'm going to have kids and I'm going to bring them to a game, you know, and I want them, I almost want to go up an obstructed view to tell them that it's not always going to be, you know, 10th row or whatever. Like, you know, it's hard to navigate bringing up kids when you have some type of success and money and showing them that you have to work for everything you have. You just can't give your kids everything, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's a struggle that I see happening. Not that, you know, like, it's funny because I work so hard. I want to sit there now. I don't want to sit in the bleeds. Mm-hmm. But by my dad giving me that experience, I appreciate when I go and sit in a 10th row or I get great tickets to an event. I know the alternative. I have something to compare it to. Mm-hmm. And I just the something to compare it to feeling, I guess.
Yeah, no, I can relate to that as one of your kids, you know, hypothetically, because, you know, I grew up, you know, with famous parents and parents who had cash, you know, and they could afford to sort of take us anywhere they wanted to, and they could give us everything that they wanted, but they were very adamant about, you know, within our four walls, you know, you don't get everything that you want. You know what I mean? You have to work for your shit. You can't take things for granted. And the way the punishment worked in my family was the small things. We got not the big things, not when I get arrested for paintballing and all the stupid shit that I did. Not really punished for that. Punished for the small things when you're being an asshole. You know, when you're taking things for granted, when you're spoiled, those were when they came down on us hard, because it was important for them, for us to understand that, you know, this isn't the real world. It's your world, but this is not real life, you know. But I always said, because my mother has an amazing story, just her success story is just an amazing tale, you know, going to New York when she was 19, getting discovered and dancing in go-go cages in Las Vegas. I mean, it's just an amazing story. And I remember as a kid, when I was 15, 16, I was almost upset. You know, I'm jealous. I will never have that story, you know. I wanted that story, you know, I wanted to have some sort of a tale like that. And, I mean, I have my own, you have your own struggles, no doubt, but you know, I think spoiled to me is not about getting a bunch of shit. I think you can be given a lot and still not be spoiled. And then you could be given little and be spoiled, you know, it's just about the appreciation for things. And I make a point with my kids to tell them, like, you're lucky fuckers. You have to know how lucky you are, you know. Yeah. But I get that. I get the almost fear in a way of like, whoa, you know. Now you're growing up with everything that I didn't have, and who are you going to become now? You know.
Yeah, totally relate to that, and hopefully I'll navigate those waters successfully. But something that's definitely in the back of my head.
Because yeah, it's going to be counter to everything you know, you're going to want to protect and insulate, and daddy can make everything right for your son and your daughter. And sometimes you have to kind of stop yourself from trying to make everything perfect. And I'm struggling with that to this day with my daughters in her early 20s and in New York, and starting an acting career, and a daughter who's in LA at USC. And, you know, when they come to me, it's like, what do you want? I'll do whatever. I'm here for you. And it's hard to be like, you know, that part-time job you've been talking about, it's time to grab that. And they're getting there, but that's something that as a successful parent, you're going to have to figure out.
Does your dad ever say to you, like, no, I don't want, like, that's too much. I don't want you to put that in your act, since it's so centered around your father. Is he ever like, he's like, Sebastian, don't talk about this shit. Don't say that. Never.
Because as long as you're making money, don't keep doing.
Yeah. So, I love that.
You don't care. There's nothing off limits. At least I haven't hit anything.
That's great. Well, thanks, brother, for talking.
Yeah,
to us.
We appreciate it. I'm obviously a huge fan, and for you to come on means a lot. All of our Zoom issues getting back on, and this is obviously a difficult time to talk about some of the stuff that we talk about, because it seems irrelevant. But at some point, you know, hopefully change will happen in society, and we'll be back to kind of life as we knew it prior to the pandemic. So keep doing what you're doing, and God, it's fun watching you do your thing, Sebastian.
Yeah, man. Thanks, brother.
Stay safe, and I hope to meet you guys in person one of these days.
Yeah, if you ever want to sit next to me at a Bears game, or just send your pop. He can do a little, you know, he can do a little trim up job on my my hair replacement. He can he can dye my replaced hair, and then he can sit next to me watching Mitch Trubisky try to sling it around Soldier Field.
Listen, I don't want to spoil my dad. I want to put him.
Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah, you can spoil him too, up the chain. Great. Good. Well, then send your kids. We have good seats at Soldier Field.
Oh, cool. Well, thank you. I appreciate it, guys.
All right, brother.
All right. Bye-bye. Take care, man. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye. Buddy.